Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to a general election discussion. What has Labour done for us? One of the common themes, I think, in the press coverage of this election so far has been, frankly, that it's been a bit dull, and that the debate and the battle of ideas has barely been joined. We've had some rather stylized presentations by the different parties. There's obviously been a debate about immigration, if you call it that. But a lot of the press coverage has said, where are the big ideas? Where are the big differences? And relatively little focus, I think, on the record of the existing government and any kind of assessment as to whether it's been a good one or not. So in an attempt to raise the tone of the general election debate, I thought I would invite some of the LSE's finest minds to put themselves to this task. Unfortunately, none of them were available, but we did persuade Nick Crafts, Nick Parr, John Gray and John Hills to stand in for them. And this evening, they're going to give us their assessment, either a general one, I think, as in the case of John Gray, also, but John Hills, of course, in particular, is focused on inequality, Nick Barr on education issues, etc. So, without more ado, the way we're going to proceed is that they've each got 10 minutes, and then we'll open it out to you, and we aim to wind up about 7:45. Okay, and the order of batting, the opener, is John Gray.
Thank you very much. Well, can you hear me? Howard Davies rightly remarked that this has so far been a rather dull election on the whole, and I'll begin by saying that I think one of the reasons that it's been dull is that both election debate as a whole and the government's representation of its case in particular has been conspicuous by the important issues it's neglected. Perhaps the most important of all for the long-term future of this country and the world is the environment and global warming, which Mr. Blair himself has described as the largest single threat to the present pattern of life of human beings on the planet. It's been significant almost by its complete absence. And that, I think, is part of a pattern, which is that the government has shelved a number of important issues and debates until after the election. In respect of the environment, it shelved a very important debate, and I say this as someone who's not necessarily opposed to what the government might do in this respect, on nuclear power, nuclear energy. There are many signs that there's a move to towards nuclear. If that's so, it's a very large step, and it may be a right step, but it has to be debated. It's not being debated. So I think that's one reason is that that's been missed out. A second is on domestic policy. Although the government has policies which is or about pensions, there is a big review of pensions going on at the moment, and we don't know what it will say. So we don't really have any clear idea as to what the government's basic view is on pensions. And that interacts with a broader theme, which is the extent to which our present prosperity is debt-based. There are very high levels of consumer debt. Many people don't have pensions or have inadequate pensions. They treat their houses as their pensions. Prosperity seems to be based to an alarming extent in this country on unsustainable debt. That's been an issue which is featured nowhere in the election campaign, either by the government or by the other parties, perhaps because they don't have convincing answers to a situation which can only be resolved by some degree of pain in the future. Third issue is Europe. None of the parties have made much of Europe, and the government hasn't. That's been shelved too. It might be that the promised referendum on the European Constitution never happens because the issue is decided by voters in a different country. So you can have the pleasant experience of having your democratic rights exercised by somebody else. So here are three big issues where I think they've been really shelved. And that's one of the reasons why the campaign has been unsatisfactory and dull. How can voters decide on how to vote? I think one of the few things most observers are agreed about is that there isn't much enthusiasm among large numbers of voters, either for the government or for the principal opposition party, and the second opposition party, the Liberal Democrats, although doing well, has not yet appears to have made any major breakthrough of the kind which it was hoping to do and that many people wanted. How can we make this decision? Well, I'm certainly not in the business of telling people how to vote. I can only suggest the way that I can only tell you how I think about it. It seems to me that you have to decide what's most important. And there seems to be a fundamental division here between British policy with respect to the rest of the world and British domestic policy, about which my colleagues will talk in greater detail. How important do you think Britain's relationship with the United States is, and in particular Britain's involvement in the Iraq War has been? If you think that is immensely important, as I happen to myself, then that will have a very profound effect, whatever your view of the war, actually, on how you vote. But of course there is an argument that if one votes on that one issue, either voting tactically against the government, against the Blair government, or simply not voting for the government because of its policy on the Iraq War, then you are putting at risk achievements which the government may claim to its credit in domestic policy. And of course, I'm less expert than my colleagues are on these issues. I'm less expert about the pattern of redistribution which government policy has been attempting and which has to some extent achieved. So all I can say is you need to make a fundamental decision. You need to make a decision about, unless by a miracle one of the parties embodies all of the values that you cherish and nurture, and you find yourself agreeing with all of their policies, then you have to decide what's most important. And there may be a decision which you have to make in terms of whether you think Britain's role in the world is entitled to that priority, or whether you are sufficiently attached to the perhaps comparatively modest gains in terms of redistribution that the present government can claim to its credit. So that leads me to my final point, which is that about the political system. The Blair government was elected in 1997 with an unprecedented majority in British democratic history. It retained that majority at the last general election. And yet in terms of fundamental policy, there's been no fundamental policy shift, as it seems to me, as compared with the Conservatives beforehand. In foreign policy, the country remains in the very close relationship with the US that it has been for many years. And economic policy as a whole, although tilted by Gordon Brown to some extent towards redistribution, perhaps mainly from the middle to the top and the bottom rather than from the middle to the bottom or the top to the middle, remains, it seems to me, essentially within a neo-Thatcherite mold. So a question you might want to ask yourselves is whether, given that the largest majority in British democratic history produced no fundamental shift in policy, whether there might be something wrong about the existing electoral system and the existing party system in this country. And in that case, if you think that, as I happen to myself now, I come to think, then there might be an argument for tactically voting. It's a sort of bit of a gamble, it's risky, but for tactical votes designed to reduce the Blair majority to the minimum, the ideal outcome of this election on this view would be a hung parliament, which would trigger a change in the electoral system. And so I think that's something which tactical voting, it seems to me, is perfectly legitimate democratic practice, especially if you think, as I do, that the present system isn't working that well. Thank you.
Well, Gordon Brown famously claimed just a few weeks ago that he was responsible for the longest continuous period of economic growth since 1066 or some other extravagant date, and was rather taken to task for this by Nick Craft. But whether you're going to talk about Gordon Brown's claims or not, I'm not sure, but you're on next.
Thank you, Howard. Yes, I will talk about growth and productivity. I want to focus on the domestic agenda, if you wish, and I suppose I wanted to get you to think about how much have things really improved under Labour. As an economic historian, got a simple answer to that. It's far too soon to tell. Can't possibly tell for several decades yet. I've divided it up, first of all, into the Chancellor's tale, as Chaucer might put it. So let's start with growth. The Chancellor could rightly point to the fact that growth in real GDP per person in the economy averaged just under 2% under the Conservatives through their 18 years. It's been about 2.3% in the first 7 years of Labour. There's an acceleration there which pretty much matches the US, looks hugely different from the rest of the EU, where growth in that criterion fell by about 0.7 of a percentage point over that period. Secondly, the Chancellor is indeed boasting about stability. So he will point out correctly that GDP growth in his period of office has been the least variable in the G7. He'll be able to point to 50 consecutive quarters of growth, 51 quarters shortly. He can surely say to everybody with total conviction, this hasn't been the boom and bust experience of the 1980s. And I think on stability, he can also say, there seems pretty clear evidence that the new macroeconomic policy framework with the Bank of England has reduced inflationary expectations. This is a step forward from where macro policy had been under the previous government. Unemployment might matter a lot because, amongst other things, of the impacts it has in relation to happiness, for example. Well, unemployment on the standardised rate used in much of macroeconomics in the OECD was about 6.9% in early 1997, is now about 4.8%. So there has been a reduction in that. And at the same time, employment has risen from about 26.5 million to about 28.25 million. A small increase, but a steady increase over that period. Sort of half-time comments at this stage might include, if we want to evaluate what Labour has done for us, we do need to take into account the legacy they got and the degree of difficulties of the conditions they've encountered. I'd want to argue that the legacy and the degree of difficulty were hugely more favourable than in 1979. I think that is something important to take into account. And I'd also like to suggest that probably all the elections I can remember, 1992 was the best possible one to lose. The smartest thing they did was to lose the election in 92. I'd also want to point out, in terms of the legacy, and I think John was touching on this as well, that Labour has gratefully accepted most of the Thatcherite supply-side reforms. They've not in any way essentially been reversed, even if they've been nibbled at the edges. And I'm thinking of things like industrial relations, privatisation, the change in the structure of taxation that took place in that period, and the government's attitude to subsidies, or in EU-speak, state aids. If we were to, I don't think we'd want to put the shadow chancellor's tale up against the chancellor's tale, so let's call the second half the sceptical economist's tale. If you wanted to say, well, a little bit of that story is spin by not telling you some of the other things, let me make it look slightly less rosy. If we look at labour productivity in terms of GDP per hour worked, well, that hasn't accelerated. It's actually decreased very slightly since 1997, and someone who was worried about what the government had achieved might well say its policy with regard to the productivity agenda has not really delivered any improvement. It's not made things worse, but it's not made things obviously better. If you wanted to be slightly more critical than that, then I think you would probably turn to something like the World Competitiveness Report produced by the IMD. If you looked at that, this is a supply-side analysis looking essentially at future growth prospects, then Britain's ranking has fallen from 11th in 1997 to 22nd in 2004. There's a bigger sample now than there used to be, but seven countries have overtaken Britain in that period. If you look at specific things on productivity, most economists, I think, would like what's happened in terms of competition policy. There's good reasons for strengthening that, and that has been done. On the other hand, they might worry quite a lot about Labour's propensity to regulate, and business, it seems to me, has some reasonable worries about regulation. And if one's thinking of what government can do for the supply side, I know a few people who think that its infrastructure has seriously improved in the last 8 years. On stability, there I think the external environment is something we should take into account. Much easier to navigate the economy through the last 7 years than either the 1970s or the 1930s. As I did say in the Financial Times column that the director referred to, the longest sustained spell of growth in the UK, for my money, is not the last 12 years. It would be the 26 years between 1947 and 1973. Measured on an annual basis, that's the longest spell of sustained growth. And if one were to turn to industry as opposed to GDP, many of the Chancellor's own party and party supporters might note that industry has been through quite a severe recession. Far from 12 years of continuous growth, there were 3 years of continuous recession in the early 21st century. And in terms of choice in the election, the Bank of England framework, which I think does deserve a lot of praise, is now a non-party matter. If one's praising the MPC for the stability of the economy, one should credit the innovation, but one should recognise the innovation is there for posterity. Finally, on employment, employment has increased, but employment growth has been skewed towards the public sector, at least if you count it as most of us would. Public sector employment, as defined by the Labour Force Survey, has risen from 22.8% in 97 to 24.4% in 2004. There's been a tendency to rely on the public sector to sustain employment growth in the recent past. Maybe nothing particularly wrong with that over a spell of years. It could be a worrying trend if it were continued far into the future. And on employment, something which plainly has not been adequately addressed is the issue of economic inactivity. The classifications that we work with in labour market trends, employment, unemployment, and economic inactivity. Economic activity among prime age males, I'm sorry to say, looking at the statistics, I realise I've passed beyond that now. Prime age is apparently 25 to 54. I think a steward's inquiry should be called for there, but still. Inactivity, that's neither employed nor unemployed in the statistics, has risen from 5.9% in the mid-90s to 8.6% now. There's a very important agenda to address there. Concluding comments, the sort of full-time wrap-up. Well, I think Gary Lineker would be getting out of me at this point. Point one, the government does deserve credit for consolidating a good initial position. It hasn't thrown it away. It's improved things in some regards, as I've tried to say. Having said that, mutatis mutandis, if you like, as an economic historian, it reminds me just a little bit of the golden age of growth in the 1950s and 60s. On the surface, quite a pleasant experience, but are future growth prospects really improving? I'm not so sure.
Thank you, Nick. Now, next up is John Hills, who, amongst other things, runs the Centre for the Analysis of Social Exclusion, and who is going to talk to us about onion domes, I forecast.
Oh, okay.
Maybe not.
I'll try and bring in an onion dome if I can. The inducement which got me here as one of, I guess, what must be one of the LSE's rougher minds, if we're not amongst their finer minds, was, of course, the opportunity to plug a book, which is why we mainly come here. The book, if you really want to know what's been happening under New Labour to poverty and inequality, which is what I'm going to be talking about, is called A More Equal Society, written by myself and my colleagues at Case, available from the Economist bookshop as soon as it opens in the morning. And I want to start, perhaps, I am going to talk about the kind of Life of Brian question, what has New Labour done for the poor, and what's it done about inequality, with a quotation from our conclusion. So apologies to those of you in the audience who have read our conclusion, but it reads as follows. Most of the authors have failed to find evidence of marked changes in the direction of fulfilling socialist objectives. Their analysis presents a gloomy picture. The government did not diminish inequalities of income or did not reduce them very much. Considerable poverty remained. It is impossible not to feel a sense of dismay. That is, in fact, from a collection of essays edited by Peter Townsend and Nick Bosanquet, reflecting on the Wilson government of 1964 to 66. And I think it's a little bit of a warning about how it's too early to tell. Because in fact, if one looks back at the achievements of Wilson government in the 1960s, inequality reduced, poverty fell to a level which we can now only envy, and living standards grew for nearly all income groups. But looked at from the perspective they were looking at just 1972, they reached a rather different conclusion. Poverty has not come up very much as an issue in this election. It did surface at the global level yesterday a bit, and this is perhaps, I think, surprising. Because the government does have quite a lot of powerful bull points it can put forward in terms of what's happened. First of all, its big extra commitments in terms of public spending have been on the core public services of health and education, which by and large either benefit everybody equally or tend to have a pro-poor bias, because poorer people use the health service more, families with children are poorer than other families, and yet are funded by a tax system which is, at least generally speaking, proportional. So the effect of increasing government spending financed by that kind of taxation, for instance through the increase in national insurance contributions to pay for universal services, has been redistributive towards those on low incomes in a way which isn't captured by the figures of people's cash incomes through which we normally measure poverty. I think it's also noticeable that as well as that commitment to health and education, that if you add up the extra resources that have gone in, just comparing the share of national income, so doing this as rigorously as one can, the share of national income which is going into support for families with children through the tax and benefits system and through support through things like services for families with children, an extra 1% of GDP, more than £10 billion, has been channeled in that direction. It's a very considerable change in the direction of public resources and national resources. It's also true that measured in the way it's done conventionally in Europe, I won't go into the details, child poverty has fallen from, one might say, 25% to 21% between 1996, 97 and 2003, 4, the most recent figures published a month ago. And it's possible the government may well hit or get close to hitting its ambitious target of cutting child poverty on a relative basis, on a tough moving target basis where the target moves up as incomes rise, by the year that's just finished, although we won't know that for a little while. And if you look at the figures we do have for when for instance, families are asked about whether they can afford certain items, whether they're under financial stress in different ways, there were really very striking improvements on indicators such as whether lone parents ever had money left over at the end of the month. Stunning improvements in some of those indicators in terms of deprivation between 1998 and 2001, 2002. I think also in the government's bull points, one can argue that there really has been an unprecedented, certainly in the last quarter century, focus throughout government on poverty, low income, poor neighbourhoods, social exclusion in general. And I think very much to the government's credit, it's recognised that social exclusion and poverty are multidimensional problems. It's not just about income, it's not just about services. There are lots of different aspects of people's lives that are affected, and there are very large aspects of government policy that bear on it. And it's what we have seen. You can tick a lot of boxes where things have been done. And where Gordon Brown was talking about this on one occasion, he said it's not just about cash or just about services, it is of necessity about both. And there's also been a very clear focus on some of the long-term drivers of disadvantage and inequality, particularly through education and training. And we've just heard about economic growth, the extent to which that can be ascribed to the government or its innovations or not. But it is certainly true that on the conventional measure, we do have the lowest unemployment for nearly 30 years, and that roll call of statistics do matter. So there is a genuinely good story to tell here, and I think it's quite interesting why we haven't heard more about it, which people might want to speculate about. Certainly touching on many aspects of poverty, many aspects of social exclusion, and some aspects of inequality, and I guess if I have to mention the onion dome, I guess that's where it's come in, that if one's looking at what's been happening to inequality, it's much more noticeable that the bottom has been moving towards the middle than that the top has been coming down towards the bulge where most of us live. But, and I think anybody here from other parts of the European Union would perhaps want to point out that although child poverty is falling, Britain started in the mid-1990s with the worst child poverty rate in Europe, and the most recent figures we have now, a few years old, predating some of the biggest, most recent tax credit reforms, we've now only got the fourth worst child poverty rate amongst the EU 15, as they were. So there's a very long way to go before we hit the government's long-term target for 2020 of being amongst the best three or four in Europe on child poverty, which is a current ambition. I think a second point one would want to make is that administration matters. And I think that was very clearly illustrated by what happened when the poverty figures came out just before the election was called. And they were, I think, to many of us, rather disappointing figures in terms of the reforms that had come in April 2003, that it was, perhaps compared with some of the mechanistic computer models we use, rather disappointing that child poverty hadn't fallen faster. But what that reminded us was that for those computer models of what the effects of changing tax and benefit policy are to have their effects, of course those changes have to reach people's pockets. And we all know that when the new tax credit system came in April 2003, it took some time before the tax credit payments actually reached people's pockets, in some cases up to 3 months. And of course, throughout that whole time, we were sampling people's incomes to see what they were, and the poverty rate wasn't improving the way one might have expected. Thirdly, and I think this is on the topic of poverty and inequality, it's quite clear that inequality itself overall has not been a focus of government policy. In fact, explicitly, in a famous interview, Tony Blair once said that it was no business of his to make sure that David Beckham earned less money. Although perhaps in terms of achieving some of their family policy objectives, it might be better if he had. But what's clear if one looks at the results, is that inequality at the very top continues to increase. Continues up to the figures we have for 2003. So the very top 1% do continue to do very well, and in some ways have continued to do well. But interestingly, if you look at figures looking at the top 10% versus the bottom 10%, you begin to see something of a narrowing in the inequality gap. So unlike the Thatcher years, where it was very easy to say inequality was widening at all points in the income distribution, in the New Labour period, there are parts of the bottom that have been catching up on the middle, parts of the top, near the top, that haven't accelerated away so fast, but perhaps some of the people at the top of the uninspire that Howard referred to have continued to move away. And then finally, last but one on these buts. The default policy that the government has followed has continued the policy that has been in place since 1981, that the level of social security benefits is linked to prices. So automatically, if nothing else happens, the poor who are dependent on benefits fall further behind. Now, in fact, my notes say here, TB policy has been clearly redistributed. What I meant there was that tax benefit policy has been clearly redistributed. Perhaps what I should have said was clearly GB policy has been clearly redistributed. And it's been redistributed from the top to the bottom. And that can be seen clearly in the figures we've produced, the figures the Institute for Fiscal Studies has produced, and clearly not just in the particular year when national insurance contributions went up, but across the period. If you compare what the tax and benefit system would have done with what would have happened if you'd kept it as it had been in 1997, it's quite clear that it's people at the bottom that have been gaining, and it's people nearer the top that have been losing. So although the government may not say this very strongly, it's quite clear that that's been the effect of policy. But with the policy of price linking, unless those kind of extra measures keep coming each year, then the ground that's been gained in terms of poverty rates will tend to be lost, and there are groups left out. And the most conspicuous group left out are the working age population without children. Pensioners at the bottom tend to have done well if they claim the benefits to which they're entitled. Families with children have done very well. Children themselves, if they're sharing that income, have done well. But working-age people without children, if they haven't been the ones that have got the jobs, are on benefits which are way below any idea of a poverty line, and which is steadily losing ground in relation to other people's living standards. And of course, although unemployment is lower, as Nick said, there are many people who are out of work who are not counted as officially unemployed, and the rate of inactivity has not fallen very much, indeed for men, not at all. And then a counter but, and I think it's very important to end on this, for any US citizens in the audience, thinking in US terms about how we measure poverty, I've been talking so far about trends using a European-style relative moving target measure. If you start looking at the government's record since 1996-7, against a US-style poverty line, which doesn't change as society becomes better off, then you see what are actually stunning improvements. Just to overall poverty on one basis down from 18 to 10%. For pensioners, against that kind of fixed real standards, the number of people living below a particular standard, if you set it in 1997, has halved. And for children, again, something very close to the US poverty line as far as children are concerned, you would see the poverty rate falling from 25% to 11%. Now, when you talk to American colleagues, that is a far greater achievement in a shorter period than the whole of the war on poverty period between 1962 and 1972 achieved in the United States. And those things matter, and you see them mattering in terms of people's living standards. And then finally, I think, if you look at the period from 1997 to 2003, at least, overall, the story is one of all income groups having rising living standards, if you take them together, apart perhaps from the very bottom and perhaps from the very top, by very much the same amount. Now, what that means is that inequality hasn't fallen very much, but it does mean that people at the bottom have had the first sustained increase in their living standards that we've seen in Britain since the early 1970s, and that's something that's worth having, although clearly there are very many big gaps for whatever government follows.
Well, last, and in American terminology, batting cleanup, we have Nick Barr, professor in the European Institute, author of The Welfare State as Piggy Bank, only begetter of top-up fees, which are used as the second most important rallying cry by the Liberal Democrats. So, single-handedly responsible for the Liberal Democrats' position in the polls.
Well, thank you very much. Good evening, everybody. I would like to talk a bit about education, about pensions, and about healthcare. I probably won't have time. I will go as far as I can. Education, first of all. First of all, schools. Policy. There's been a substantial increase in spending on education, as we've heard. There's also been some welcome shifts of focus from later years to earlier years, from inputs to outcomes, and also a focus on the variance of outcomes. In other words, concentrating on improving standards in the poorer schools. So there's good news on policy. On implementation, which is much the more difficult part of the task, it's a mixed bag. There have been improved outcomes, and there is some evidence that the greatest gains have been in the poorest performing schools, and there's been a concentrated effort to bring that about, but there's still room, a great deal of room for improvement, and particularly in some of the worst schools. And there's evidence on mobility, that social mobility in the UK is still poor by international standards. A besetting problem has been the staying on rate post 16. So the people are leaving school at 16 in much too large numbers. So schools, some good things going on, but a mixed scorecard. Higher education. There, as some of you know, I'm an enthusiast. People agree on the core problems of higher education. Students are poor and universities are poor. And people agree on the objectives, improved access and improved quality. The question is, how do you do it? And it's not always clear to those who've been away from universities for many years how much the world outside has changed. First of all, we've had expansion. When I was an undergraduate, 5% of young people went to university. Today, it's 43% and rising. Secondly, that expansion matters. In the old days, higher education wasn't really that important. Today, it matters for national economic performance. It matters for individual life chances. So that expansion has been important economically and socially. But you can't finance a high-quality higher education system entirely off the back of the taxpayer. That's particularly true with increased international competition. Now, people then rear up and say higher education ought to be funded from taxation. So just a few words on why that is not the right way to go. Higher education fails on access. 2 years ago, if you took 100 young people from professional backgrounds and 100 young people from poorer backgrounds, 81 of the first group went to university, 15 of the second. That is a shameful record. So let's not pretend that tax funding of higher education did such a great job. It also failed on quality. You know,
LSE students need no reminder of the fact that we are more crowded than we would like, that staff-student ratios are not what they were 30 years ago, and we've been relatively protected and are doing rather well compared with a lot of other universities. Finally, tax funding is deeply regressive. If you increase taxes on the richest people, as the Liberal Democrats propose, and supposing that raises $5 billion, why spend that on the best and the brightest who are going on to become the richest, rather than on promoting access where it really matters, nursery education, improving the staying on rate post 16. So with that as background, what's the government done? It's brought in a policy with three elements. The first element is variable fees, but they're deferred fees. They're not paid for by the student, they're paid for by the graduate after graduation. Deferred fees promote quality by bringing in more resources for university. I would argue they also promote quality by creating competition so that universities use those resources more efficiently. Second element is a good loan scheme, meaning loans are organised not like a mortgage or a bank overdraft, they are a payroll deduction alongside income tax or national insurance contributions. So if someone's earnings drop or go to zero, their loan repayment instantly drop or go to zero. It's those two measures that free up the resources for the third element in the strategy, which is active measures to promote access. And as an economist, I must be allowed one demand curve. If you've got a demand curve and you move price up, of course that's going to reduce demand and harm access. So if all you do is raise fees, of course you harm access. But if you take some of the money and spray it over those from poor backgrounds, that shifts their demand curve out and to the right. So it's actually not very complicated. It's a policy with two elements, not one. It's raising tuition fees for the average person, but then targeting resources on people from poor backgrounds. The deal is universities are free for students. Their fees are paid by the student loans company on their behalf. Money goes into their bank accounts to pay for most of their living costs. Poorer students get a grant. And it's paid for, still very largely by the taxpayer, but a chunk of it will now be paid by graduates when they have graduated and when they have an income. So the soundbite is students get it free, it's graduates who repay. So it's really not very different from the way it was for my generation. It was free for me as a student. The only difference today is that as well as paying income tax, graduates also make a loan repayment. So I've spent a lot of time arguing with Labour backbenchers. I think the higher education policy is a deeply progressive social policy that any socialist politician ought to be proud of. But it has to be said, this is an argument that not all backbenchers up to now have found totally convincing. So one ploughs on. Pensions. What has Labour done for us? Well, the good news is there's been a considerable increase in the incomes of the poorest pensioners. The bad news is that has come via a sharp increase in means testing. And for reasons I'll come on to, that is not a policy that I think is going to be helpful in the long run. What should Labour do? Well, we've heard about one or two deferred debates, and the pensions debate is one such. John Hills, as you know, is a member of the Pensions Commission, which issued an excellent first report last October, which diagnoses the problem. The second report is due out this autumn. I have been my usual noisy self and suggested what I would like to see it say. And there are four elements, and I will just mention two and spend a bit more time on another two. Element one, a higher effective retirement age. It drives me absolutely mental when people talk about the ageing problem. There isn't an ageing problem. People are living longer. This is wonderful news. This is arguably the great triumph of the 20th century. But of course, if people are living longer and retirement age is fixed in perpetuity at 65, there's going to be a problem about paying for pensions. And if you were designing a pension system for a brand new planet in which you were told the native life form was living longer and longer, you wouldn't choose a retirement age fixed at 65 forever.
you would choose a retirement age that bore some sensible relationship to life expectancy. So I think it is essential that average pensionable age rises. It should be higher. It should also be variable to give people choice. It also seems to me very silly that you force people to step off a cliff on their 65th birthday, to leave full-time work on Friday and be fully retired on Monday. A lot of people would like to move gradually from full-time work towards full retirement, and that seems to me an essential part of the story. So that's the first element. The second element, which I will just mention, is a higher state pension with no means test. The means test interferes with labour supply, and we want older workers to work more. It interferes with saving, which is another part of the puzzle. So higher state pension with no means test. Simple savings products and annuities I will just mention in passing. And finally, public education. Public education remind people that somebody who retired in 1950 had almost certainly left school at 15 and worked till he was 65. So short education, 50-year career, short period of retirement. Do the same figures for today: longer period of education, shorter working life, and vastly longer period of retirement. So by suggesting that people work a bit longer, you're not taking away some massively cherished entitlement. You are merely slightly adjusting the balance, moving a little bit closer to the sort of working lives that my grandfather had. Finally, to wind up, I will skip healthcare. The great debate: what has Labour done for us? I think it has brought into the open a great debate about how you should organise public services. And this is a quote from a speech that Tony Blair made about 2 years ago that I thought merited more attention than it got. I'm quoting: "The greatest sadness is when people describe the pursuit of excellence as elitism. It is surely in the nature of things that some parts of a service perform better than others. But it is the oldest and most damaging shibboleth in the left-wing book that levelling down is the route to equality and social justice. In fact, it is excellence within a public service that provides a spur to greater achievement and the levelling up of the whole of the service. Without that, those who could afford it bought their way out of the public service. The result is elitism, and worse, on the ability to pay. That is real two-tierism. So the debate is, do we think of public services as something that is done by Soviet-style central planning with absolute uniformity as the aim? Or do we have more decentralization in a more complex age, with the result that some bits of the public service will perform better than others, some universities, some hospitals, and that is used as a lever for progress for the whole system? Now, that's a big debate, and people can legitimately take different views on it, but I think the government has done an important service by bringing that debate out into the open. Thank you very much.
Well, Nick, as long as you're prepared to teach half a dozen first-year econometrics courses a week, you can stay on indefinitely. Now, we've heard a huge list of things between the pluses: child poverty, strong economic growth, school outcomes, HE policy, some aspects of pensions policy. On the other side, we've had growth in inactivity, we've had problems for childless people out of the labour force, nothing much on productivity, declining industry, and as John began with, the avoidance of a number of issues like Iraq, global warming, and indeed the longer term future of pensions. So a big agenda, but it's now over to you to quiz our panel further, or indeed make your own points, because I don't think this is just a question and answer session. We're happy to have a debate, and if you could say who you are, the microphone will be given to you.
Steve Schiffer is BBC News. Just wonder if the rest of the panel could address the points Nick Barr is bringing about, up about choice, because I think one of the issues that is a big issue
choice
going to play out in the public services. And I was just wondering, and labor approach to bringing more choice, and B, whether they see any pit in greater choice and inequity, for example.
John, pointing at you at the end.
I was hoping to claim to be very much one of LSE's less fine minds on that particular question. I'm not going to answer that directly on question of choice, but I am going to put forward what seems to me to be a bit of a dilemma on this, which is that part of the focus, a lot of the focus on health and education overall, has for obvious electoral and governance reasons been focused on standards in the middle. After all, that's where most voters are. And when we did our survey of what had happened as far as outcomes and policies towards poverty and inequality over the last 8 years, it was noticeable that there had been a very strong focus on health inequality, which had not been there before. In fact, those of you who can remember back before 1997, people working within government were not allowed to talk about health inequality. They had to talk about what were quaintly known as health variations, and the big report that had come out, Peter Townsend and others involved with, in 1980 had been virtually suppressed, that there's been a very commendable focus on the problems, but much less has followed by way of action, and that's not a very controversial statement. Indeed, the Treasury's own documents have said that a lot of analysis has been done on the structure of problems as far as health inequality is concerned, but putting resources into the NHS of itself, while it improves services that are generally used by people to have tend to have lower incomes, don't necessarily ensure that those with the imbalances in take-up of services by those with lower incomes are met. And I think higher education is another case in point, that expansion that Nick was talking about that's happened over the last, let's say, short generation since Nick was has been disproportionately, as he said, from people with already privileged backgrounds. And one of the most striking figures that's come out recently, it was reiterated again yesterday or this morning's newspapers by the Centre for Economics of Education here, is that if anything, social mobility slowed in Britain between those born in 1958 and those born in 1970. And one of the drivers of that has been that we have, in one sense, become a more meritocratic society. Your educational achievements matter more than they used to, but the people who get those educational qualifications are more likely to be those from more privileged backgrounds. And so there are big issues there, which the government has attempted to address, certainly in terms of poor performance in poor primary schools, but there's a very long way to go, and simply improving public services overall doesn't necessarily get you there. And I'm afraid I don't have an answer as to whether the choice agenda of any of the parties will make any big difference to that.
I think when it comes to choice, there is a view that says more choice is always better. And that presupposes that people are well informed. So choice in clothes, choice in CDs, fine, markets work brilliantly, makes a lot of sense. Where you talk about social services, I've argued school children are not well informed. University students are much better informed, and that's one of the key reasons why I support choice and an element of market forces in higher education, but am on the whole fairly opposed to them for school education. Healthcare, again, we are not well informed punters. These are highly technical areas. So what that means is, in those areas, choice can be a driver for improvement, and it can be valuable in its own right. But it needs to be constrained choice because people are badly informed. Therefore, what you are talking about are not free markets, but regulated markets. And this is where I think the government has a strategic approach that I think is sounder than that of the conservative opposition, that it's not saying choice is good always and everywhere, markets are wonderful always and everywhere, but it's saying choice is good, but we need to constrain the way it's exercised so as to make sure that consumers have choice but also have the protection they need in areas which are too complex for them necessarily to make their own unconstrained choices.
I think before I throw it open again, just one question that I'd like to put from the chair, because it's maybe I should be responsible for the dogs that don't bark in this debate. And one dog that did not bark at all was the dog which we were hearing a lot from before the election was announced, which is the question of civil liberties, the legal system, detention without trial, the government's constant battles with the lawyers. None of the panel have mentioned this. As far as civil liberties are concerned, John, because I know you've written about this, what has Labour done for us?
Well, it would be a bold speaker who would say it's greatly improved the conditions of civil liberties in this country. I mean, you might have a kind of, someone might cobble up a philosophy for the government in which restriction of due process, the refusal to put the case strongly of British subjects held in Guantanamo, and perhaps most strikingly of all, the apparent legal acceptance in British courts of evidence obtained by torture in other countries. One could invent a social democratic philosophy, and this was all highly progressive, but I think it would be pretty implausible. So I really can't see any reasonable argument other than that the general condition of civil liberties has declined. Now, there are complicated issues. I don't say that there can never be arguments for restricting some civil liberties as a result of serious terrorist threats. But the way that this has worked, and in particular, I think, the judicial rehabilitation of torture is a massive change, which has not only been the dog that hasn't barked here, but it's really, except to their credit, on the behalf of lawyers who object to this quite consistently and to other aspects of civil liberties legislation of the present government, it's had far less of an impact, a massive change of this kind. One of the few really profoundly progressive changes of the 20th century, not the abolition, of course, but at any rate the legal prohibition of torture, it seems to have been blurred or chipped away at the edges. And I think that's really a rather profound black mark against any government that's presided over it. It needn't have been this present government, it could have been a different government, but in fact it was.
Thank you. Next. Yeah, right in the middle at the back, and then I put you.
I just wondered, it's not particularly academically rigorous exercise, I know, but I just wondered, if you went back and you know, the Conservatives had won the last election, what material ways do you think that the country would be different now, and which people do you think would have benefited, and which people wouldn't have benefited?
This is a what-if economic historian question, I think.
let's have a think about that. It seems to me that as far as macroeconomic policy is concerned, the moment for the independent Bank of England had probably arrived theoretically. There were clearly strong voices within the Conservative administration who would have liked to do that. I think we might not be too far away from the same macroeconomic framework. I think in terms of pursuing supply-side policy, since there's not been a big difference really between what the two parties have done over the 90s and early 2000s, again, probably not very much difference there. I guess, if anything, the Conservatives would possibly have regulated slightly less, if you wish. So if that was a worry, that might be something which would look a little bit different. I suspect the structure of taxation at the margin might start to look a little bit different there too. I wonder if a Conservative administration at some point wouldn't want actually to expand the tax base in terms of indirect tax. I would have thought if you're a Conservative Chancellor, you'd worry about the narrowness of the value-added tax base. And at some point, that might be your favoured way of pushing forward rather than national insurance contributions. I suspect the really big differences would be in the domain that John Hills was talking about, in the sense that I would be very surprised if we'd seen anything like the same attempt at redistribution or alleviation of poverty. Those were issues which I think were not high up the Conservative Party's agenda. So on the sort of macro and micro efficiency issues, some minor differences at the edges perhaps. I think the main difference in thrust would probably be much more on the equity redistribution aspects.
John?
Yeah, I think that's very clear. I don't think there was anything in the policies leading up to 1997 or the manifesto put forward in either 1997 or 2001 by the Conservative Party that would have suggested anything like the introduction of the minimum wage, the introduction of the extensive tax credit system for families, or indeed the scale of the improvement in the means-tested minimum for pensioners, if they claim it. So I think one way, the answer to the question is quite clear, that significant proportion of people on low incomes would be worse off today than they actually are as a result of those transfers. I think it's also true that there would have been less of a focus on what was going on in general in low-income neighbourhoods. So some of the things that we've seen, like Sure Start, some of the new initiatives, would certainly have been slower coming, although maybe some of the same social forces would eventually have driven them. And I think it's probably also true that we would not have had a one-less review, we would not have had the scale of increases in spending on the National Health Service that we've seen. We might eventually have seen an increase just because of the sheer political pressure to do it. And I think one of the, in some ways, one of the most interesting achievements of the government in the most recent term is the way in which the opposition has locked itself into the spending plans that have been announced for the next 3 years, and that the argument about how much would be spent is about changing the rate of growth rather than cutting that back substantially. In other words, all of those increases in tax resources going into health and education have been accepted, and some of the increases planned for the next 4 years have also been accepted and debated elsewhere. I think that is very different from where we might have been before.
Would there have been the same number of British troops in Iraq, Tom?
There might have been. I think on balance there probably would have been. I don't think the situation would have necessarily been significantly better in that respect under, if you take my view of the war, if there'd been a conservative government. But it is slightly more surprising as having emerged from the present from the Labour government.
Another question was there, and then I'll continue. Was it you?
Stephen Hamer. At present, we live in a country where we have a relatively regressive tax system, at least more regressive than it's been at epochs in the past. We have a very unequal, or more unequal, distribution of income, and we have, or we aspire to have, a system for delivering public services in health, transport and education, which gives all citizens a broadly similar standard of consumption in those areas. What I want to know is, are those three things ultimately compatible? Surely, to answer my own question, if you have an unequal distribution of income and a regressive tax systems, you ultimately
sure that I buy the premise entirely. You can argue, I mean, the tax system is not very progressive, but it's at least proportional. I think that you can... I would defer to John Hills, but I'm going to base my answer, and then I will hand over to John, on the presumption that the tax structure is fairly proportional. You can finance redistributive social services on the basis of a proportional tax because, I mean, just to oversimplify, if everybody gets exactly the same amount of health and education, but it's paid for out of proportional tax, then higher earners will pay more for their dollop of health care than lower earners will. So proportional taxation plus an equal dollop of public services is not inherently contradictory. I think the only thing I would add is it's... let me leave it there.
John?
Okay, well, I mean, first of all, the question of is the tax system progressive? For most of the income range, the best information we have is that the tax system is pretty well proportional. Whoever you are, between about the sort of 15% from the bottom and 15% from the top, you're probably paying about, one way or another, you're paying about 38% of your income in tax. And that's because people at the bottom pay a bigger proportion of their income in indirect taxes, people at the top pay a bigger proportion of their income in direct taxes, income tax and national insurance contributions, and the two, it all pretty well comes out in the wash. However, right at the bottom, people pay a bigger proportion of their income in tax, and right at the top, people pay a lower proportion of their income in tax. They're saving more, and they spend, they get caught less. So if you take the thing, for most people it's a pretty well proportional tax system, you pay a share of your income, but at the ends it's technically regressive, it's not progressive. Now, the what's happened to the distribution of income, it depends where you look. I would say that the best way of describing it is that overall the distribution of income in, as so far as we know, up to 2003 is much the same as it was in 1996-97. There have been some changes. That in itself is quite an interesting achievement, because up until that point inequality had been rising, so you can argue that at least what's happened has stemmed the growth in inequality. It's taken a lot to achieve that. But what I think is interesting in what you've put forward is that if you look at our website, the Centre for Analysis of Social Exclusion case website, on the LSE website, you may see a paper that was recently published about public attitudes to redistribution. Some qualitative research that was done for us a year ago, looking at people's attitudes to this, and broadly speaking, people support the idea of a tax system which is at least proportional, if not actually progressive, that is, people on higher income should pay a higher share of their income in tax, and public services that go equally to all. Now, they don't say that because they see government as being some great big Robin Hood, and that the aim of the exercise is to quote, redistribute income. They say that because they apply two separate principles. One is that money should be raised fairly, and that means in proportion to people's income at least, if not slightly progressively, and that also access to services should depend on need. And one of the respondents to that qualitative research in a focus group really was confronted with this, with saying, well, so what you're saying is to each according to their needs, from each according to their resources. And I think this was a rather conservative focus group, certainly in older people. And the respondent said, yes, that sounds very communist. Am I being a communist? No, in fact, that is mainstream British opinion. Mainstream British opinion believes, as far as we can see, that there is a chunk of social of life and forms of consumption where access should be according to need. You're part of the club and you're in the club if you pay in according to your income. Now, that has quite strong redistributive effects. It does tend to increase the resources at the bottom and reduce them at the top, but it's supported probably not on the basis of this Robin Hood idea of trying to work out an ideal income distribution. It's a kind of byproduct of what people see as two different principles of fairness operating in different domains.
So another question about that.
Thank you. How much do you think does Labour depend on the relatively strong economy with their redistribution programme? I mean, if the GDP stops growing as much as it does, would there still be a shift, as you said, from the to the bottom, or would then there be more money put into the middle classes again?
Shall I give one quick reflection on it? Sorry to be hogging answers. I mean, in one sense, it would actually make life easier for the government because of this moving poverty target problem. I mean, the government is committed to reducing child poverty on a relative income standard. And one of the things that's made its life difficult is that average living standards have risen so fast in the last 8 years. That means that the relative poverty line is far higher than it used to be. If growth stalled and that line didn't grow, then the effect of the increased spending on tax credits and so on would actually and the value of the mean-tested pension at the bottom would have been greater on poverty than it's measured in those ways than it's actually been. And of course that's only a short-term effect. I mean, if the economy slowed, unemployment rose in the way that it did before, then obviously a lot of government resources then disappear in that direction. There are fewer resources available to finance some of the programs that have been brought in, and the tax, you know, the pressure downwards on tax bites harder. If the economy isn't growing, people's living standards in general aren't growing, they're going to get a lot more unhappy about any increase in the tax take, and therefore politically harder to get the resources that have, you know, the 1% of GDP that's gone to families with children, or services for families with children, would have been harder for the government to garner if living standards hadn't been growing. So yes, if the economy slowed, I think these things would be tougher.
I mean, there's another set of arguments that bear in the same direction, though not immediately. That is, services that are labour intensive, of which education and healthcare are prime examples, need slightly more than the rate of inflation each year just to stand still. I can explain why. But so that means spending on healthcare and education, and we've heard it's a huge amount and it's been rising quite sharply, need to rise more than inflation. If growth stalls, that then itself becomes harder to finance.
I think it depends also how the slowdown takes place, because this affects the demand for government spending, if you wish. So if unemployment is a result of the slowdown, there's a whole set of new transfer payments to be made. That does intensify the fiscal squeeze that you have in mind. More generally, though, I think the interesting thing would be if the slowdown comes through some change in the rate or bias of technological progress, then that might actually have rather different implications. We might have, if you like, growth-based slightly more unemployment and slightly less on technical improvement. That has a different story about it altogether. And if one thinks about the general challenge for redistribution policy, there's somewhere where the environment surely has been getting more difficult. It's that technological change has essentially been biased against the demand for unskilled people. Unskilled people have been losing out very badly, and that in a sense has been generating a moving target for the sorts of policies that John has been discussing. So exactly how the slowdown comes about, where on the supply side the change has happened, would have quite profound implications, I think.
I think it's a very interesting question, because if you think back to previous governments, often the revealed preferences of the government become clearest when they have to cut.
Yeah.
And this government really hasn't had to do that, so we're slightly in the dark. There's one over there, microphone behind you.
Charlie Kiss, Birkbeck, economic student. I just wanted to ask the panel what they thought about the private finance initiative, because it hasn't really had a good press lately as regards school meal provision and the funding of the underground.
I'm not a deep expert on the private finance initiative, but from the little I know about it, it does seem as though government has paid a high long-term price for the short-term gain of getting some public spending off the books. As a general point, separately, one of the problems with privately produced commodities is it's important that you can regulate quality properly, and that depends on contract design. And if there is one thing that governments of all parties have been remarkably consistent about, it's an inability to design contracts that pin down private suppliers to deliver that which government had at the back of its mind in the first place. So I tend on the whole to be rather grumpy about the PFI.
Thanks. We have a few more questions, so let's take another one. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Well, you go next, and then the man in the sort of black type shirt. Okay.
Yeah.
John Hills first.
Okay, well, just two points. I think it's very important when one's talking about the situation of different social groups is that there have been very different movements as far as different ethnic groups are concerned. And you can look in terms of educational achievement, although that isn't translated as it ought to be, from qualifications into employment levels or pay levels, from some people from an Indian background. You see very different position for people from a Bangladeshi background in terms of of what's happened. I think it's very important not to, to lump all groups together. And interestingly, the biggest difference we now see in secondary school performance between those that we know are poor because they're on free school meals and those that we know are poor, who are not poor because they're not on free school meals, is actually amongst white boys. It's where you see the biggest poverty penalty, if you like. So the news is very, very mixed. The second point I would make is that in terms of immigration per se, and my colleague Tanny Burkhart writes about this extensively in the book I was trying to plug earlier on, is that if you look at all the dimensions in which the government has taken great care to improve inclusion, and then you look at the position of asylum seekers, you see almost systematically that rights to income, rights to housing, rights to employment have been reduced. Of course, this is not a debating point at the moment as far as the election is concerned, because there's a lot of debates in the other direction. I think once you separate out those two different questions about what's happening to ethnic minorities within Britain and also what's happening to particular groups of people who've recently arrived.
Do you want another question?
Well, I mean, I'm glad the question was raised because this is a very... it has become a central issue in the election, and for that reason alone, I think we need to think about it, because it also interacts with issues of due process rights, in this case, various types of rights to asylum from tyranny and so on. So I'm glad it's been brought up, and I agree with John Hills, although they're not entirely separate, it helps if we separate those issues connected from asylum, from issues about the relative advantage and disadvantage of different ethnic groups in this country.
Patrick Murphy. The Labour Party was elected in 1997, committed to an ethical foreign policy, yet in office, most of its decisions cannot be classified as progressive. The case could be made for its domestic agendas being very progressive, but I don't think many people would say the same for foreign policy. My question is, why is this the case, and is it likely to change in the future?
I think it might be John again.
It's surely very unlikely that this would change under another Labour government. And it's also unlikely that there'd be a fundamental shift if there were a Conservative government. So if you want a fundamental shift, you have to vote, it seems to me, in a way that shakes up the existing party system. If you want a basic shift of foreign policy, there is no way to do it by voting in the present government or by voting for its major main opposition. The only way is to trigger a difference in the system. As to why it's happened, well, I mean, it's been disputed. There are lots of books that have been written about the Iraq War in particular. I think one point to be made is that the original proclamations about an ethical foreign policy were extremely vague. There aren't many people who oppose an ethical foreign policy. One has to actually try and specify what that means. But the minimum, I suppose, it would mean is giving your reasons for going to war before you do it.
Woman on the front right here. Can you wait for the mic? Just wait.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
I'd like to refer back to about civil liberties, and you, Professor Barr, about devolved decision-making. I've been poor a couple of times in my life, and I'm rather used to that. But what I feel now, more than I've ever felt before, is that this government is interfering and controlling my life in a way that makes me feel really uncomfortable. We preach democracy to the rest of the world. I feel that our government has been less and less democratic the longer it's stayed in power. And one thing that comes to mind, and this isn't an advert for the Conservative Party, we didn't like poll tax, we protested, they changed it. We didn't want to go to Iraq, we still went to Iraq. This government is supposed to be custodian of our morals and ethics and all the rest of it, but when we say with a very loud voice what we want, we get told what's good for us, what we should do. We're losing our freedom. Forget about the money. What about our freedom? I feel that I don't have it anymore.
Nick? Is the government over-controlling economic life?
I was going to say, I mean, I'll only talk about the social services, which are the patch I know about, or I'm less ignorant about than the broader issues. I think the idea of, I mean, there was a time when the view was, you are the patient, shut up, let the doctor do medicine to you. And the government's moving away from that, and quite rightly. There was a time when the government said, you shall be educated until the age of 15 or 16, and we will tell you what you will get. We will sort of prepare you for the labour market. Much more choice, much more diversity. It's important, it's necessary, it's a good thing. But then you get things going the other way, like food. You know, the government is starting to say to people, if you live on a diet of chip butties, it's going to be bad for your health. If you smoke like a chimney, it's going to be bad for your health. And I mean, I've been critical of government for being too afraid of seeming to be a nanny state, and been arguing they should be much more forthcoming in the advice they give the public about what a good diet feels. So you can tell stories either way. I'm not going to comment on the Iraq war, because it's not something that I have any comparative advantage on, except to say, I mean, governments, if government only did what people wanted, then we would have referenda about everything. And it's not clear that, I mean, my political chums say democracy ought ultimately to be the right to throw the rascals out every few years, but in between times they need to be free to govern. Now, part of the trouble is when they do exercise leadership, people who approve what they do say, ah, political leadership, good thing, we need more of it. And when they do things that we disapprove of, they say, why is the government doing it? It's overturning my democratic rights. And I'm not saying that unsympathetically. I think our views are very much shaped by whether we agree with what the government do. You know, they're right-wing bastards for bringing in university tuition fees, say some people. They're being deeply progressive by doing so, say I. No easy answers.
Hello, what are we going to do? We're going to take one more question, and then we have a question for you. But the question I'll take, because we're running some slightly over time already, so we'll take one final question.
I think we've been, by and large, discussing the parochial issues, and that's right. But I think one of the single failure by Blair is not to stand up to Sharon and Israeli aggression. If you look at the poverty among the Palestinian children, the atrocious way the Israeli government is behaving. And Blair is not able to stand up, calling a conference here, making a showpiece. For 50 years, these people are refugees, living in a dire condition, and not standing up to Bush and say, this is it. The Europeans are prepared to do that, but not Blair.
You can interpret that blank as you wish. I'm going to ask you a question, which is, taking all things into consideration, do you think that this government, the Blair government, has been a good government? And don't ask me to define it, you know what I mean, by your own terms. How many people think that the Blair government has been a good government? It's quite a reasonable number, actually. And how many think it's been a bad government? Well,
good,
it's not great news for Mr. Howard. But thank you all for coming, and particularly thanks to the panel for being asked to perform in a slightly unusual format.